Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in St. Martin's Evangelical Church against South Dakota. We'll take a little time to play the courtroom now.
Well, there'd be a natural lot of sure for this person to try to find it.
Mr. Schilling, I think you may now proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, we suggest that the primary question before the Court is whether churches that operate elementary and secondary schools are exempt from the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, which is known as FUTA, as that act is applied by the states. If the Court should find that these churches are not exempt, then we have a second question, and that is whether coverage under FUTA would violate either or both of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. The petitioners are St. Martin Evangelical Lutheran Church, which is separately incorporated under South Dakota law, and it operates an elementary day school. The other petitioner, Northwestern Lutheran Academy, is owned and operated by the Wisconsin Synod, and it is a four-year preparatory school for entrance into one of the Synod colleges in preparation for either the teaching or the preaching ministry. It should be noted that all teachers are regarded as ministers of the Wisconsin Synod. This was found by the appeals referee in the original administrative hearing. They have equal status with their preaching minister counterparts and voting rights on doctrinal matters in the church. Now, neither of these schools that we're talking about are separately incorporated. Now, prior to 1970, the Federal Unemployment Tax Act did not cover nonprofit or tax-exempt organizations. In 1970, however, Congress required the states to cover nonprofit corporations. And when it did this, it created a Section 3309B, which specifically exempted from coverage certain nonprofit employers or services. Now, the first section, 3309B1, has two parts, the subsection A, which exempts those in the employ of a church, convention, or association of churches. Subsection B exempts those in the employ of an organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes, and which is not an issue here, which organization is operated, supervised, controlled, or principally supported by a church, convention, or association of churches. Subsection 2 deals with their ministers and members of religious orders. Subsection 3 exempted those in the employ of elementary and secondary schools. The other exemptions are not pertinent to our case. In 1976, Congress again amended FUTA, effective in 1978, requiring primarily coverage of state and local employees, agricultural workers, and domestic workers. And when Congress did this, it eliminated that elementary and secondary school exclusion. And this is where the controversy begins.
Suppose there's never been that third exception.
What?
Suppose there had never been that third exception.
I think that third exception.
Well, you think it's just superfluous or not?
I think it had no effect on parochial schools.
It did on non-profit.
It did on other non-profit schools.
Yes.
And perhaps it had an effect on public schools.
But it was never needed to exempt the kinds of schools involved in this case.
That's our position, yes, sir, Mr. Justice.
Although that was never the view of the service, I guess.
That was not the view of the Labor Department.
Yes.
After repeal.
Or before.
Well, I think before, Mr. Justice, it never had occasion to arise. And I don't think the Secretary of Labor.
Didn't they issue exemptions?
No, you don't get an exemption. Exemption is automatic, Mr. Justice.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the fact.
So you never have to.
You don't apply.
Yes.
Or do anything to get it. Uh-huh. It's there, and it's you use it.
So you never knew. You never knew why the tax wasn't collected from religious schools. You didn't know which ones of the exemptions was being applied.
That's correct. Well, after this exemption, this elementary and secondary school exemption was removed, it seems that the state bases its argument on repeal of this subsection 3. We maintain that the statute as it remains is clear and that the statute controls and that legislative history or intent is really not an issue.
Are you talking about the South Dakota statute?
I'm talking about the South Dakota statute, which is a mirror image of the federal statute.
But if the South Dakota Supreme Court has construed the South Dakota statute, aren't we bound by that?
I don't think so, Mr. Justice, because the South Dakota statute is so closely interwoven with the federal statute.
That question bothered me in reading the briefs in this case, and the only discussion of it I found was in footnote 2 of the government's amicus brief, which is rather short and may be correct, but you don't, the parties don't discuss that question, whether or not this doesn't involve purely a question of state law.
Well, I suggest, Mr. Justice, that it does not, because the penalties to the states if they don't comply are so severe.
But the state Supreme Court seemed to be talking about the South Dakota law.
Well, I think it sets
it out on page A3 of the appendix of its opinion, and that's the one it discusses.
Are you suggesting that because of the interaction with the federal law in question in the case that alters the usual rule that we won't re-examine state court's interpretation of its own statutes?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that, but for the jurisdiction, of course, is there with the constitutional question we've raised. But I think the court also, without the constitutional question, has jurisdiction to decide this question because of the interrelationship between the state statute and the federal statute.
You're saying that it's like the Zucchini against Scripps case we decided 2 or 3 years ago, where we felt that the state court might have decided this case differently had it not been under a misapprehension as to federal law?
I think that's correct, yes, Mr. Justice.
I think that's reasonable.
Well, that's the position the government takes.
Suppose we ruled that the federal law didn't intend to subject religious schools to this tax. Suppose we just ruled that. You would still be subject to them in South Dakota until the legislature acted.
We think this court has the power, Mr. Justice, to overrule and reverse the South Dakota Supreme Court.
Because as to the meaning of a South Dakota statute, this court lacks the power to do that.
Until the Supreme Court changed its mind, the South Dakota statute would continue to mean exactly what it meant.
Well, unless under cases like Zucchini or Bengay Consolidated Mines, we were to vacate and remand for reconsideration free of the any misapprehension the state court might have had about the federal law question involved.
If you did not want to get to the constitutional question, yes, Mr. Justice. We don't really think you have to get to the constitutional question.
Well, the point is that if the U.S. State Supreme Court construed the state statute in reliance on an understanding of federal law that we say was erroneous, then we send it back. We couldn't change it for the U.S. State Supreme Court, but we could send it back to them as the suggestion, and let them reconsider their interpretation of the state statute in light of what we've said about the federal question.
That might be correct, Mr. Justice Brennan. Mm-hmm. But then I think we'd have to come back if they would not follow our wish.
We might have another case.
And we'd have another case because we do have the constitutional issue. Yeah. I think that the South Dakota Supreme Court interpretation was so heavily reliant on what the Secretary of Labor suggests and so heavily reliant on what the federal statute said, because they kept using the 3309 provisions, that I still think that would be our position, that this court does have jurisdiction aside from the constitutional question. But our position under the statute, whether it be South Dakota or the federal statute, is that these churches are exempt either under subsection A, because the services performed are in the employ of a church, convention, or association of churches. We also think they might be exempt under subsection B, because the services are for an organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes. Our argument primarily is based on the statute. I think we first discuss A. I think under subsection A, we have to define the simple language, service performed in the employ of a church. And I think we have to define what the word church means. Now, the South Dakota appeals referee defined the word church very narrowly. He said the word church meant an individual house of worship, as has been interpreted to him to mean by the Secretary of Labor. We think the appeals referee is wrong.
And the Department of Labor.
And the Department of Labor is wrong, because a building can't employ somebody. I think the facts show that the school operated by St. Martin's Church is not separately incorporated. It's not a legal entity. The members of the church congregation control its operation. And number three, the school is completely financed by the church. If the tax is going to be paid, it's going to be paid by the church. Likewise, Northwestern Lutheran Academy is not separately incorporated. Its control is by the Synod, and its principal source of support is from the Synod. If you look at the common dictionary meaning of the word church, it refers to a body or organization of religious believers. And that's, I think, the definition that we should use. I think it's interesting that when Congress recodified the Internal Revenue Code, in 1954, it stated that the term should be all-inclusive and should be interpreted to include other organizations, which as integral parts of the church, are engaged in carrying out the church's functions, whether individually incorporated or not. I think there are two excellent briefs by the Catholic Conference and by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that trace some of the legislative history. From time to time, Congress has used these same words, church, convention, or association of churches. And, of course, it's our position that when Congress did this, it kept the same meaning. We think Congress intended a broad and a general meaning. Now, when Congress recodified the code in 1954, the words or religious order were also in the statute they were talking about. And those words or religious order were deleted because I think Congress thought that would limit and confuse this broad definition that they intended. The United States, as amicus curiae, implies that church schools are not exempt under this section because they're not a church. Well, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is whether these church schools or whether services performed in these church schools, which are not separately incorporated, are performing services in the employ of the church.
Are you saying that they are essentially the same, substantially the same as the Sunday school classes or summer school classes held at traditionally at Lutheran churches and others?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice. I think the school is a basic part of the church's mission.
In other words, it's an implement of the faith of that church.
That's correct, Mr. Chief Justice.
Is it governed by state rules?
The church.
Does it follow the state rules for education?
The state rules of education.
Do they supervise those schools? Do they enforce the attendance laws? Does the state enforce the attendance laws?
Mr. Justice, the state heretofore has not really enforced their certification requirements, their attendance requirements. They do submit attendance information.
Well, do you do that for your church school?
Yes, they do.
Your Sunday school, do you do that for your Sunday school?
Not Sunday schools, we do not.
Of course you don't, so they're different, aren't they? Aren't they different?
Well, Sunday schools are not a requirement of compulsory school attendance, but the day school is.
I said in answer to the Chief Justice that it was just the same as the Sunday school. You didn't really mean that, did you?
I meant insofar as the inculcation of religious doctrine goes, I did. Insofar as state requirements of education, I did not. I think this question of state requirements and certification is one that might very well get to this court someday.
Well, the state has police power to require attendance at primary school, does it not?
Yes, it does.
It could not, under the religion clauses, compel attendance at a Sunday school. The state of South Dakota couldn't compel people to go to Sunday school, could they?
No, they could not. I think that would violate the Establishment Clause. This question of certification has been before three states and these requirements, and I understand that Ohio, Vermont, and Kentucky courts have restrained the states from enforcing their certification requirements on parochial schools. I understand
that... You referred to the Synod, and according to your brief, the membership of the Synod is churches themselves rather than church officials. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In the Lutheran organization.
That is correct.
The dictionary meaning includes both.
That's correct, Mr. Justice.
So the Synod is an assembly or a group of Lutheran churches.
That's correct.
Not of people.
That's correct. The membership are the churches.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Shelley, maybe I'm laboring the point, but the referee found, as I remember, that the primary purpose of the school was education rather than religious training. Do you dispute that finding?
Yes, I do dispute that finding. The referee found that religion is inculcated in everything they teach. But then he said that the primary purpose was education. And I think the word primary means fundamentally in the first place or of first importance. And it's our position that the reason that churches provide a school system that's coterminous with that the state provides is strictly to inculcate their religious beliefs. Insofar as the Wisconsin Synod goes, its constitution provides for conserving its doctrine and for extending its doctrine. And its constitution specifically provides for schools. I think the schools, insofar as the
These
Wisconsin
schools
Synod
do perform goes, the same educational function that public schools do insofar as a general education is needed by a child.
They do.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
But they have certainly, this logically, they wouldn't even exist if they didn't have some function beyond that.
That is correct. Their function beyond that is to inculcate the religious doctrine into everything they teach. And I think that was recognized by this court in the establishment cases in the early 70s.
Well, is it any different in this situation from the schools of the Roman Catholic churches and others that we've dealt with?
I think the situation insofar as Roman Catholic schools or Baptist schools is all the same. I think the statute that we're talking about, if we're talking about the federal statute, is so broad that it, no matter what the organizational structure of the church, it's covered under this exemption. I don't think there's anything peculiar about the Wisconsin Synod.
Are these schools restricted to Lutheran children, or can other children attend?
They're not restricted. Primarily, attendance is for those who are Lutheran. I think they would.
Well, that's not true in the Catholic parochial schools, is it? Yes.
I can't speak for the Catholic parochial schools. Well, I think they're pretty similar insofar as they're inculcating a religious doctrine.
And I gather from what you just said, or said a few moments ago, that you don't think that the question of whether the church is a separate corporation is a dispositive question.
I don't,
in this
Your
case,
Honor,
they are not.
I don't think the fact that...
In this case, they are not, and you rather emphasize that in your statement of the facts.
We emphasize the fact that they are not because, in our case, of course, we have that fact. Right. But I think if you read Congress's statement, which also appears in the conferee statement when they recodified the code, they use the term that whether they're carrying out the functions of the church, whether as separate corporations or otherwise. So I think under this broad definition of church, convention, or association of churches, they were all inclusive, no matter what the organizational structure of the particular religious body is.
So even though something were incorporated separately as a school, albeit a parochial school, that would not be a dispositive question in your submission?
I don't think that would be a dispositive question.
Why are the institutions of higher learning that are religious covered?
Why are they covered? I think there's a difference between elementary schools and secondary schools.
But how about for purposes of the statute? Why wouldn't an institution of higher learning that is controlled by a church, why wouldn't it fall within subsection A or B?
Well, I think their freedoms...
Because it's still part of the church.
But I don't think their purpose in college is primarily religious. That is for most church colleges. Some, that may be true. But I think for most church colleges...
None of them. All of them are covered.
They're included.
All of them are included.
They're not exempt.
That's right. None of them are exempt. Nobody goes through this routine of seeing whether they are performing a church function or not.
Insofar as colleges, that's correct.
How long has that been true?
I think since 1970.
Were they not covered before?
They were not covered before.
Because why?
Because they were a nonprofit corporation.
And then
the nonprofit corporations were not included within the provisions.
And that was repealed.
And that was repealed in 1970, at which time they created this subsection 3.
How did you know the colleges were exempt under that section rather than under the church section?
They were never exempt because Congress did not provide an exemption for them unless they could come in under 1. That is, they could come in as primarily religious. I think Congress, when it spoke when Congress came out in the 69-70, when they brought these various nonprofit organizations in, specifically said in its reports that a separately incorporated organization like an orphanage or a home for the aged would not be covered. And it specifically said that in these reports that institutions of higher education were meant to be covered unless they were seminaries or novitiates or something like that.
Would your argument be different if the if Exemption 3 prior to its repeal had well, anyway, the exemption that was repealed had exempted the employees of church-related and other private schools?
I think our exemption would still come back under 3309B1, either A or B.
Even though Congress had thought that it was repealing the exemption for those people?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
Well, it seems to me that under the plain language of 1A, at least, to be exempt, the employment has to be of the church or convention or association of churches, not of a separate corporation.
Under subsection A.
Right. Now, B is something else again.
Except for Congress's definition.
Well, I'm talking about the statutory definition. In the employ of a church or convention or association of churches. That's not a school.
But they're in the employ
of a church.
Of a church.
And your clients are, you tell us.
That's right.
But it would be dispositive of whether or not they were a separate corporation, wouldn't it? And if the employment were by a school, then 1A wouldn't cover it.
They might then come under 1B.
Might or might not come under 1B.
That's right, Mr. Justice.
So the corporate organization is dispositive, at least with respect to 1A, isn't it?
I don't think so, because when Congress defined the word church, convention, or association of churches, it used that language, separate corporation or otherwise, in its definition.
Well, I'm looking at the statute, which is what Congress enacted. And the exemption is for somebody in the employ of a church or convention or association of churches.
If you look strictly at the statute, then it would appear that separately incorporated schools would not come under the subsection A. They would have to find their way into subsection B.
And that's what you stand on.
Stands on both. In this
I stand
but
on
you're
both,
standing on
Mr.
B.
Chief Justice. Well, we're standing primarily on A.
But you...
And B.
You are standing on B. That's
yes, Mr. Chief Justice.
If you can't come under A, then you'll take B.
Then we'll take B. Yes, Mr. Justice Brown.
Rely on B. And, of course, I understand you disagree with the referee's characterization as you operated primarily for religious, I mean, for educational purposes, but would it not be necessary in every case involving a church-affiliated school for the taxing authorities to make an ad hoc decision as to whether that particular school was primarily for religious purposes or primarily for educational purposes, rather than having a general rule that would cover all schools? I mean, all non-public schools, yeah.
Aside from this constitutional question, that might be the answer, Mr. Justice.
There might be a large number of individual determinations that would have to be made in order to determine the scope of 1B.
That's quite possible, Mr. Justice.
And you'd have to decide what religion was, too.
That might be, but we might have the establishment problem.
Your problems were certainly non-existent before they repealed 3.
That's right.
We had no problem.
You fell right under 3. Right. And now you say you also fall under 1A and 1B if you can't get under
1A. And
1B.
Or we have a constitutional problem.
Could you comment just on one thing that's mentioned in the opinion below? Is the number of employees that Congress thought it was subjecting to the statute. They used a figure that your opponents argue demonstrates they must have been intending to include the employees of parochial schools generally.
Well, with respect to those numbers, all I can say is in a footnote in that report, there was a bigger number of 261,000 instead of the 242,000. And that referred to teachers, that 261,000. And if we would then bring in our cafeteria workers and our bus drivers and our janitors and the other school people, that number would grow. So I have trouble relating this 242,000 figure. The only thing I have to go on is what happened in the Alabama versus Marshall conformity hearing, where the administrative law judge rejected reliance on it based on testimony that had taken place in that matter, that there was no record Congress understood that figure, and there was no supporting data with the figure. And then, of course, he refused to go along with it because they were the issues involved, what he said, were integral church functions.
Were there any hearings on this exemption? When it was revoked?
Yes, but the primary hearings were all involved the public, right. State and local.
But there's
employees.
Nothing in the hearings, no data in the hearings as to what kind of employees were, how many employees were being.
Mr. Justice, never in the congressional record or debates does the word church or church employees appear.
Where did those figures come from? It was 242 and 261.
The figure was 242,000 employees of private schools. That's what the figure is.
That's correct, Mr. Justice.
Well, where did that come from? Is there any evidence in the hearings as to where it came from?
I don't know. I think there was examination of people in that Alabama. I'm not familiar with the Alabama case.
Well, no, but in the congressional hearings.
No, there was no discussions on that figure.
Nothing in the hearings, nothing in the testimony taken, none of the correspondence.
None that I found, Mr. Justice. I would like to reserve some time.
I'm afraid your time has expired. Sir. Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, amici curiae, the states of Alabama and Nevada, submit that in order to resolve this case, the Court need look no further than the plain language of 26 U.S.C. Section 3309(b)(1), subsection A. The uncontradicted facts before this Court demonstrate that employees of church schools, such as petitioners, are, quote, in the employ of a church or convention or association of churches, close quote, and thus fit squarely within the statutory exemption provided by Congress. The question that was raised earlier concerning the basis for federal jurisdiction, or this Court's jurisdiction, over the statutory interpretation here, I think is answered by two factors. Number one, a review of the South Dakota Supreme Court decision makes it clear they are relying solely on their understanding of congressional intent and the meaning of the federal statute. They state at page A5 of the petitioner's appendix, in the opinion there, the threshold issue is congressional intent. And I think the language of that opinion is clear that they are relying on their understanding of the Secretary of Labor's interpretation and of the interpretation of the federal statute. Under those circumstances, there are a number of cases from this Court that stand for the proposition that an erroneous understanding of federal law, which is introduced into a state court decision, is properly the subject of federal review, even though the state court could choose voluntarily to read its own statute differently. Where it states that it is relying on its understanding of federal law, this Court can correct such a misapprehension. I think one of the best cases for that proposition is Standard Oil Company versus Johnson, which is cited at 316 U.S. 481. And at page 483, the Court makes it quite clear that it will review an interpretation of the California highway tax because the California Court interpreted that tax by reference to its understanding of federal law concerning the definition of an agency or a part of the United States government. And we think equally here, the state Supreme Court has interpreted the federal law, and it has interpreted it incorrectly. In considering whether church school employees are employed by a church, as required for the B1A exemption, it is important to bear in mind that the statute and the implementing regulations expressly define the words employer and employee. And they define them so as to incorporate into the unemployment compensation law the common law rules for determining whether an employer-employee relationship exists. They set forth such factors as the right to control and direct the individual's work, the furnishing of the place or tools of the work, and the right to discharge the individual. In this case, as counsel for petitioners has already indicated, the church schools involved are run directly by the church or the synod. They have no separate corporate or legal existence, and therefore these schools are typical of the great variety of schools that are described in the stipulated record, which is before this court in Marshall versus Alabama and Nevada, number 8922. While those stipulations by the Secretary of Labor are not binding on the parties here, we believe they are helpful in understanding the position of the Department of Labor, which position was then adopted by the South Dakota Supreme Court in the decision that's under review. The Secretary has stipulated, as a matter of fact, that in our states, all of the Catholic, Lutheran, and Fundamental Baptist Church schools have no legal existence separate from their respective churches. In those schools, church officials, such as the pastor or the priest, hire and fire all the employees of the school. Church officials discipline and control the work of the employees. The church owns the building in which the school operates. The employees' salaries are paid directly from the church bank account. Therefore, we believe it is uncontradicted that every key element of the common law definition of employment as incorporated into this statutory scheme is present here. Nevertheless, the Secretary of Labor and the South Dakota Supreme Court suggest that the word church should be confined to mean the physical house of worship rather than the legal entity that owns the building and hires the employees. As is set forth at some length in the briefs in this case, Congress has consistently provided for a broader definition of church in the Internal Revenue Code.
Well, you normally know, you wouldn't suggest that normally when you say, when you use the word church, you think about a church school at the same time.
No, sir. I think you normally.
Ordinary language, you talk about those things as different entities.
Mr. Justice White, I think normally.
Maybe legally you're quite right, but most people would say, where are you going today? They say, I'm going to school, not to church.
Mr. Justice White, I think it does depend,
ask
obviously.
Ask somebody where he works. He says, I work at the Baptist school. He doesn't say, I work for a church.
I think it is correct, Mr. Justice White, that it depends somewhat on the context in which you're speaking. If someone says, on Sunday, I'm going to church, they may perhaps be talking about the building, or they may be talking about the worship service. But Congress used the word in the employ of a church. And we submit that a church building cannot employ anyone. That in the context of who is the employer, when Congress is setting out a statute about the payment of wages, about the withholding of taxes, that the phrase in the employ of a church, in that context, we submit had to refer to the definition as Petitioner's Counsel has stated, that is also a common definition of church, which is the body of believers, the legal entity.
Of course, in this case, the employees in question were in the employ of a church in one case, or an association of churches in the other.
Yes, Mr. Justice Stewart, that's correct.
However defined.
Well, the Secretary defines the word to mean the building, and I don't know how you can define the statute with that definition.
Well, you could be employed by a church and work in some other building, I suppose.
Well, perhaps that's their
point. Or you could work in a church building and be employed by somebody else.
We submit that in this context, the word church must include the legal entity that controls the building and that hires and fires the employees.
Well, indeed, building,
I'm sorry?
If the building is relevant at all to the legal issues in this case, Is it not a fact that in many cases parochial churches and schools are all one structure in a city block? One part of it assigned for worship services and one part assigned for teaching, but all the same building.
That is exactly true, Mr.
Chief
Justice.
Really important to the legal issue, is it?
I don't believe it is. I think even under the Secretary's interpretation, many of these schools, since they are in the same building, perhaps would be exempt. But we submit that reliance upon what building the school is in is not what Congress had in mind. And we think that where Congress defined employer in this statute as a person who pays wages, then in the same statute, when they use the phrase in the employ of a church, we submit they must have meant church to mean the legal entity that pays wages, the association, the corporation. Petitioners in this case are the employing entities within the meaning of that legislative language. We urge this Court to reject the strained and contorted reading of the statutory language. Mr. Justice Marshall, I believe that all church hospitals are separately incorporated, and under our reading of the statute,
well, if there possibly would be one that wasn't incorporated.
If, Mr. Justice Marshall, if the hospital were part of the church itself, were not separately incorporated.
I'm not part of the church. I'm talking about St. Isaac's church. I mean, hospital that's three blocks away from the church, but it's owned by the church.
If it is part of the church, not a separate corporation, then the literal language.
I didn't say
I'm sorry.
Part. I told you the facts. Is it a part or not a part?
What I mean to suggest, Mr. Justice, is that if the employees of that hospital are employed by the church entity, as in this case, their salary is paid from the church account.
They're paid by the hospital, but the money comes from the church.
If the hospital has a separate legal identity, in other words, a separate bank account, a separate association, corporation, or structure, then we think that it would not fit within the language of B1A.
And if a school does, likewise, right?
Yes, Mr. Justice Stewart, we think that a separately incorporated school would, in most instances, be exempt under B1B, but would not fit the B1A language as petitioners do here.
With regard to the legislative history, in the House report that the government quotes on page 10 of their brief, stated that Section 115B also has the effect of requiring the state to pay unemployment compensation on the basis of services performed for all educational institutions. You think they really didn't mean that?
Mr. Justice
86%, as I understand it, of the schools involved are church-affiliated.
That's only true, Mr. Justice Stevens, if you focus on private schools. And in fact, that language which you just quoted was directly in the context of a lengthy discussion of state and public schools, which was the primary purpose of this statute. There was no reference in that whole discussion from which the quotation is taken about private schools at all, much less church schools. In fact, the words church school, religious school, parochial school are nowhere in this statute, and the 242,000 figure that was referred to earlier is simply a figure in a table in a report opposite the phrase nonprofit organizations. There is no discussion of that figure as to what is included within that number, what type of nonprofit organizations, and the record in the Alabama-Nevada case.
Normally, when one reads, just as you say, when you work for a school or a church, you the same sort of question. When you talk about private schools, private secondary schools, for the most part, you are encompassing within that concept a very large number of parochial schools, aren't you? Do you think when one just talks about private schools, he intends to refer to non-religious private schools?
No, in terms
of ordinary meaning as used in everyday parlance.
No, I agree the great majority of non-profit private schools are parochial schools, but the phrase nonprofit schools was not in the language that you quoted, Mr. Justice Stevens. It simply said
all educational institutions.
Public schools, of course, are the vast preponderance of those and were being discussed in that section of the legislative history. Thank you very much.
Very well. Mr. Meyer Henry.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. This morning in Watertown, South Dakota, where St. Martin's Lutheran Academy is located, I think it's important to note, because the state believes the second part of petitioner's claims are most appropriate, whether or not it violates the First Amendment. This morning, when the children went to school, they all went on public school transportation. Some of those children went to a public school. Some of them got off at St. Martin's Academy. And throughout the day, these children who went on different tracks were constantly involved in numerous entanglements, if you would. They both ate food prepared by private citizens, but the food probably came under government programs. Both children in both schools could have had speech and hearing diagnostic services provided for them, which is approved. They most probably used library books furnished by either state or federal funds at St. Martin's Academy.
Well, I take it your point is that if they share some of these things, this dilutes the church or religious aspect. Is that it?
No, not so much that as to the point made by my colleague that there will be entanglement. Should this one small portion of the operation of these parochial schools be subject to some taxation, in other words, some extraction of coming under the unemployment compensation laws, whether that will so entangle the state with the operation of these parochial schools as to violate the First Amendment. My example mainly goes to point out, if it will, to the court, that this is really not an issue because this entanglement by the acceptance of these benefits by church schools has eliminated that. And here in this instance, and I argue on behalf of the state for what you will call the people employed by the schools, in other words, the cooks and the janitors, we recognized in our by our referee below and in our Supreme Court that those teachers who are on call, who are part of a religious order or part of their particular religious following, that they are exempted under Section B of the exemptions. So if they are ministers, they are not covered by unemployment insurance, and we don't make the claim that they are, but we're worried about, and Congress was worried about from the beginning of the unemployment law. What about the janitor who is laid off? What about
What about the teachers? Are they covered?
Well, I think that some would be and some would not be, depending on a factual determination. As brought before this court, those members of the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Church who were called, in other words, their contractual relationship with the school is such that they are considered ministers of the church,
well,
teaching ministers.
In any event, all of them are in the employ, either of St. Martin Evangelical Lutheran Church, on the one hand, in the one case, or by the synod in the other case. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Whether they're cafeteria employees or janitors or lay teachers or whatever.
That's correct. I think, though, that if you look at the exemptions and how they occurred from 70 to 1976 to the present, there would have been absolutely no need for the exemption of ministers and those people who belong to a religious order for the first exemption. You would have no need for that for pastors and members of the order. And the third exemption prior to the change, which we're arguing about, had to do with schools.
Right.
And everywhere in their briefs, it is always church school.
It's always what?
It's always church school. There's always an adjective. We're talking about private schools, church schools, and public schools.
Right.
But we're always talking about schools, and that's what the referee operating on behalf of the state of South Dakota found, is it was a school and not a church and not subject to the first exemption. Because if that's carried to a logical end, a religious order or a religious society could declare most anything to be in the furtherance of their religion.
General, that's the point I want. In declaring these teachers as ministers, does the state consider that their ministers for income tax purposes?
Well, we don't have an income tax but in our state, but I would say this.
That are they considered that for federal income taxes?
No. The second part of the exemption we recognize, it says ministers. And we have, in this case, given to them this exemption as to ministers. But you don't have to be a minister.
That apply to this, too.
That's right. But you don't have to be a minister to be a cook or a minister to be a janitor. And that's what the unemployment law is talking about, because if they close down a school, those people who are in the teaching ministry are called to another place. They're not unemployed.
But you would concede, I gather, that a cook in a church, which everybody agreed was a church building, would be exempt under 1A, wouldn't it?
No, I did not agree under 1A. What I said was I think that the state can make the determination, regardless of what the legal or the paper trail of the legal entity is.
Well, then you do not concede that this, when the statute exempts people in the employ of a church, that it does, that it exempts janitors in the employ of
a church. I did, sir, but the state can make the determination of what is a church purpose. And
well,
in this
no,
case...
In my hypothetical case, he sweeps up the church building.
Well, I guess it's a matter of interpretation of the
and
statute.
And he's employed by the church, and only by the church. And he knows it, and there's no argument otherwise.
Well,
take a concrete example. The cardinal of the Archdiocese of Washington has a residence and a cook and a housekeeper. Under A, is that person exempt in your view?
Yes, I would think that we would not argue that those individuals.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock. You may continue, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. In response to a question of the Chief Justice when we were broke for lunch, we would point out and we would like the court to be aware that these petitioners, and in fact all of the Lutheran schools in the state of South Dakota, have submitted themselves to the state and are accredited schools. But I want to point out that we're perhaps a unique state. We require education in South Dakota. We do not require attendance at schools. Therefore, you could educate your children in your own home, and you have to be tested to show that you're making academic progress. But you are not required by compulsory school attendance to attend a school in South Dakota. However, these petitioners, in both instances, have submitted, and I've lodged with the court the documents, a copious filing, making them an accredited school in the state of South Dakota. And that is the only time in our legal jargon that you can be called to school is if you are accredited. You're either a school and accredited under the state auspices, or you're not. But you don't have to be a school, and you comply with our law of educating your children either by doing it in your home or with a group of others. So,
how do you suggest that difference from the states which require attendance so far as the issues here are concerned?
Well, I think it goes to the definition and the exemptions. And I think that we recognize, as the court does, that this does have to be applied across the land. And when one is in the employ, as an exception, of a church or convention or association of churches, I think our Supreme Court narrowly interpret that in answer to the Chief Justice's question. That would probably refer to the cook for the bishop. And those things that are obviously only religious. There's not an educational purpose in being a cook for the bishop. But then it goes on, which is probably closer, in B of 3309, it says, or organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes and which is operated, supervised, controlled, or principally supported by a church or convention or association of churches. That's close, but we have to remember when all of these exemptions were entered, number three was in the employ of a school, which has now been eliminated. And so in answer to the Chief Justice's question, these people, in our opinion, as the documents we lodged show, which were lodged for accreditation purposes, they were filed by the principal of the school, and they were done in the name of the school.
Well, might they not have been both a school and also an organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes before 3 was repealed?
They might have been, but in South Dakota, they could not have been a school without meeting accreditation purposes. In other words, making certain statements and complying with certain academic standards and employing certain types of teachers and being open a certain number of days, which would reduce that being operated primarily for religious purposes. They were operated primarily as an educational institution.
All you're saying is that by qualifying as a school, they would have come under 3 if it were still in existence. But that doesn't really go to the 1B question, does it?
Well, I believe it does, because what our appeals referee decided and our Supreme Court decided is that this school, St. Martin's Academy, which is still going on, was not primarily for religious purposes. It was primarily for educational purposes and to be taught with religious overtones, you might say, or in the way that they wish to do it. But it was primarily for education.
But narrowly, the churches embarking in this enterprise is for strictly religious purposes.
It could be, but there is a desire wherein, I believe...
In other words, they don't want the public school system for... Some of the people don't. They don't want the public school system. They want their system with its heavy emphasis on training in faith and morals.
That's correct, Mr. Chief Justice. But then we approach...
Mr. Attorney General, may I ask, I gather that A, obviously, is limited... B can't include a church, because A gives the exemption for a church. What is an organization operated primarily for religious purposes, et cetera, which is neither church nor parochial school?
I think it would be those instances where it was an institution to train ministers. And only
seminaries, you mean?
Seminaries. It could be
Why couldn't they say seminary? That's a very...
well...
I mean, everyone knows what a seminary is.
But I think that it also goes to this extent, Mr. Justice, that certain publishing duties, perhaps certain insurance duties, that would only have something to do with perhaps the churches themselves, not a true free marketplace type company. And I think here what they're saying is it's limiting it because they're not going to allow, or Congress is not going to allow, for the purposes of covering employees of a church-related organization if they go into tuna fishing or lumbering, lumber company or mining. So it's going to be a test.
If they had a diocesan paper, for example, and they had their own print shop, would the printers, you think, fall under B, as exempt under B?
I would think not, because of the Pilgrim Holiness case, which applied the minimum wage requirements of the Fair Labor Act, because in that case, which this court denied cert, it was a lower court case, but this...
What if all they printed in that print shop were... the Bibles.
I think it would be much closer, and it would stand the test, this court having recognized...
Well, a diocesan paper is a purely religious paper, isn't it? Newspaper? At least it is in the Roman Catholic faith.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the terms. That could well be, then, if it were only to print a paper for dissemination to the church.
My hypothetical was to remove from all doubts any factual question about whether it was or was not a religious document.
I think in that case, that representing a state, I would say yes. It was organized primarily for religious purposes.
Well, would an elementary school operated by the church ever be operated primarily for religious purposes, in your view?
I think not, especially in this case where...
That's something that if the exemption is available, the authorities would have to decide. They would have to... decide between schools that were operated primarily for religious purposes and ones that were not.
I think that would be a duty of whatever government to decide that.
General, how is it impossible for a school to be a, quote, organization, end quote? Why can't it be an organization?
Well, I think because at the time it was passed in 1970, paragraph 3 directly... approach schools. It says in the employ of a school which is not an institution of higher education. And I think Congress at that time definitely looked at schools as some of the underlying congressional language reveals that they were talking about schools in a different way.
Is there any other, quote, organization, end quote, of a church that would have to comply?
Yes, I think there'd probably be a great number of them.
Like what?
Well, I can't speak, and I don't know. But I would say that if a church were to have a fleet of school buses that were organized as a corporation only to bring children to Bible classes or Sunday school classes, that organization could be organized for the purposes of religion. And if the buses were not used in general commerce for other purposes.
Well, then the church is the only one that wouldn't be. I mean, the school. is the only one that wouldn't be. It's the only organization that wouldn't be included.
I think there could be a great
number. I'm having trouble with school not being an organization. I think it could be an organization.
I think it but I think as you watch the legislative history, in 1970, they specifically approached schools. And then in 1978, they specifically said that schools, whether they're church, private, or parochial, public, private, or parochial schools, would not have an exemption, because we have to remember that this act was passed for the benefit of employees, of people who are hired by others, whether they're hired by schools or whatever, and that these were exemptions. And I think it was in the intent of Congress, as they have consistently broadened unemployment coverage, was to narrow the scope of exceptions. And when they looked at the schools, they said, if we just exempt private schools and we just exempt public schools, then are we not approaching the establishment of religion if we just overlook those religious schools, and just those employees will be without protection? And I think that's a logical argument as to why that each employee, whether he's working in a private school that may be started by environmentalists to promote an environmentalist cause and still teach, but the primary purpose is education. And so when these schools in our state...
Well, the primary purpose of this school is education.
And that's why we believe that...
But they say there's another one. It's religion. If they wanted this education, they'd send to public school.
Then there would have to be a decision made, as there was in this case, by the appeals referee, that these two institutions were not primarily for educational purposes. Because these schools, these parochial schools in our state...
We can't escape that. We're going to have to decide that.
That's right. And I think great weight has to be given to the appeals referee who did determine these issues.
Well, am I right in reading the statute as in this way, that exemption number one, both A and B, depends upon the identity of the employer, by contrast with exemption number two, which depends entirely upon the identity of the employee?
Yes.
And am I further correct in my understanding that in this case, the employer is in the one case a church and in the other an association of churches?
I guess that is, in my mind, one of the issues. I say the employer is the church, because the school, well, is the school, for the following reason.
The school itself is not an entity, is it? It's not a corporation.
But I don't
think... Isn't the employer who pays the wages the church, in the one case, an association of churches, i.e. the synod in the other?
But the fact remains...
Am I correct in that factually?
I think factually that's correct. The legal effect of that is what I would like to bring to your attention, is the fact that also their description of a church is, again, not an entity. It's an organization of believers or followers. And what we're talking about here is simply the trail of the dollar that ultimately pays for this. It does pass through the church.
That isn't just their description of the church. It's a tracking of 1B, isn't it, which says an organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes.
Yes. I believe that if they fall under any exception, it's not A, it's B, which is an organization operated primarily.
But they literally fall within 1A.
I would say not.
Literally.
No, I would say not. Because the individual, as the records show here, the individual's paid by the church, but they're employed by the school with their separate board to oversee, which is within the church, but it's a separate board which hires a principal and eventually runs a school. The entity...
Maybe we differ as to our understanding of the word employment, but it seems to me that your employer is the person who pays your salary or wages.
Well, but I think there has to be a determination for an...
In the employ of. So it's the identity of the employer.
Services performed in the employ of.
In the employ of. And the test in one is the identity of the employer, by contrast with the test in two, which is the identity of the employee.
Well, again, this is an instance, which is the only case before it, but our determination by our Supreme Court was that this instance fell under B and that it was not primarily for religious purposes.
So it doesn't fall under B. Because it's not operated primarily for religious purposes.
That's right. There is no exemption. But they approached it from that standpoint, that it was not primarily for religious purposes, but also for
educational
purposes.
It seems to me that you can't read it the way you're doing it now. And a church is certainly an organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes, is it not?
Yes.
And if you say they're in the employ of a church, they also are in the employ of an organization which is operated primarily for religious purposes.
I don't think that necessarily follows. I don't think that we could deny a church the opportunity, as a wild example, to buy a professional baseball team. I think they could do that. And I think they could set up their accounting practices in such a way that the money flowed from the church. But that's certainly not an organization, although it's operated by a church and it's supervised by a church and owned, but it's not primarily for religious purposes.
But that would be the employer in your hypothetical case. And isn't that the statutory test, the identity of the employer?
I think that
the nature of the employee's duties under one.
Well, I'm simply arguing the intent of Congress.
Refers to the nature of the services.
Pardon me, sir?
One doesn't refer to the employer. It refers to the nature of the services.
Any services. It includes services performed in the employ of.
In interpreting the language of Congress when they set out the three exemptions, I think it was clear that they separated. It's for this Court, obviously, to decide what Congress intended and what Congress wanted. But I'm not going to concede, that they are employed by the church. They're employed by the school for the simple reason, and this Court on many occasions has pierced corporate veils.
Well, but you seem to place great emphasis, Mr. Attorney General, on the fact that there is a committee, a board designated. But the minister of the church can't be expected to run everything. Can't he appropriately delegate the detailed management of the school to a subcommittee of the church? Isn't that what he does here?
They're certainly
bound to be church members, aren't they?
I would think so, yes.
Just as you'd have a committee of the church on visitation of parishioners and a whole lot of other things. So there's no corporate veil to pierce here, is there really?
Well, I think there is, because this is an organization which Congress recognized that there were going to be organizations, spin-offs from churches of other duties. And so I think that's why it comes under B. And then the test is it primarily for educational purposes, and we would submit that it isn't. The one final issue, should the Court...
If, as I understood you to agree with me, the test under 1 is the identity of the employer, then the employer is the church, which is operated primarily for religious purposes, isn't it?
I didn't agree.
As is any church.
The employer is the school, which is a subsidiary, if you will, of the church, perhaps. But it is a separate entity, and it is intended, as these schools, and they're being organized 2-3 a day, with the resultant workforce, and they're operated for different reasons, never once questioning the petitioners in this case. But private schools with religious overtones are being created 2 a day all over the country. And I suggest that that's going to require a huge labor force. Our citizens do not go to their parochial school and bring coal to start the fire. They hire a janitor. They do not take turns sweeping out the hallways. They hire a janitor.
Well, but there's no one compels them to work for this one of these institutions.
No, but the intent of Congress is, for one reason, under the unemployment law, those people who are thrown out of work, and we're talking about a very few people here, as I think we recognize, those people who are thrown out of work by the discontinuance of this operation should be covered by unemployment. I want to cover one thing and submit the rest of my time.
Just one more question. You referred to the janitor. I think very frequently in these establishments, the same janitor will sweep out the church and the school. Now, is he covered?
I think that the Secretary of Labor has directed us, and I might say I'm like two bookends here because the state's in between having our funds cut off by the federal government and be attacked on this side. I would say that then it is a test, like so many other employment tests, where are his duties lodged? And in that regard, I want to talk about the monetary effect because it's very vast, and it's very important to our state. which is according to the Census Bureau, the poorest state in the union, is the fact that money will flow back and forth no matter what this court decides. And secondly, and it's important to note, these schools need not, in our state, under our system, pay any tax dollars. None whatsoever. They can go under the reimbursable method, which is allowed for these schools, and they are not required to pay into the fund any dollars unless they lay someone off, and then they must agree to reimburse the person that's laid off. So one of the things that should be recognized by this court, although we've talked a lot of words and been in a lot of courts, it may not ever resolve in anyone drawing unemployment insurance in South Dakota, because if they are a minister and they're on call, they'll move. They won't submit to unemployment insurance. And if those other individuals truly work for the church, they'll still be working for the church when the school's closed. And
well,
so,
how about a teacher in a parochial school who's fired for teaching doctrinally wrong religion?
I think, first of all, that is an issue that probably will not come up except in very limited circumstances. But I would say this, that test is one like every other employment test. And I think that a hearing referee can very easily recognize that there is a different standard of conduct for that teacher compared to a public school teacher or a private school teacher. I thank the court for its time and indulgence.
Very well, Mr. Attorney General.
And submit my time if I have any left to my colleague.
Very well. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Until the Attorney General of the State of South Dakota rose and addressed the question of the coverage of the statute that's involved here, I had not heard a word today about the purposes for which the statute that is being construed, the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, was enacted by Congress. I would like to point out that this is a remedial statute, and that's perhaps the beginning of any statutory construction. But it's not simply a remedial statute.
Well, aren't most statutes remedial? Aren't they intended to remedy something?
I think that's right, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, and that's always bothered me about how you distinguish among remedial statutes.
Beneficent ones?
Pardon?
And beneficent ones?
Well, it seems to me that here, as this Court has said in California Department of Human Resources against Java, we have a very special kind of remedial statute. We have a statute that goes to the very subsistence of individual citizens. This statute was informed by the experience of the Great Depression and has played a vital role in our society since that time. It was understood by Congress that people in the time of the Great Depression suffered unemployment, and the result of this unemployment after protracted time was that they were forced to accept charity. This statute represents a judgment of our society that people should not have to accept charity, that they should be able to participate in an insurance scheme whereby they can work and earn benefits for the day when they may become unemployed.
Well, but if we accept that broad thing, then there wouldn't be any exceptions at all.
That's true, Mr. Chief Justice.
Including ministers of churches who sometimes become unemployed.
And, in fact, 98% of the workforce is now covered by this statute as a result of the amendments that have occurred in the past 10 years.
Well, what percentage is covered by it is the issue in this case, isn't it?
Well, I think that the number of workers who are involved in
98 or 97.
That's right. I'm not sure that it's between 97 and 98 or 98 and 99, which is why.
But the decision in this case will bear on what percentage is covered by
that. That's right. And the people who are exempted for specific reasons. Ministers are exempted because of the problems that may arise in the case of ministers, also for the reason that ministers generally aren't laid off but belong to a church who continue to employ them and may not suffer.
Well, that's true about
not true
Section 2. That is, what are you? Are you a minister of a church? But the inquiry in number one is, who are you employed by?
That's right, Mr. Isn't Justice. It? And I will reach that.
Number one doesn't ask at all, what are your duties, but who are you employed by? And number two, on the other hand, asks exclusively, what do you do?
Well, I think I might subscribe to Mr. Justice Stevens' slight differentiation in the way he has put that, because I have the sense that it would be helpful to me, but I'm not quite sure I understand the distinction. However, I think that in construing this particular statute, something has been overlooked here.
In the laundry case a few days ago, you'd find that's a very dangerous thing on which to rely.
I think that what needs to be pointed out here is that this construction of church, first of all, is not as irrational as it sounds on its face when put in the argument that a building can't employ anybody. The construction that the Secretary has given to it is as a house of worship, meaning the core religious establishment. And in that
according
sense,
to the Secretary, does a person, in order to be exempt from the Federal Employment Tax Act, have to be not only employed by that house of worship, but carry out his duties in that house of worship, his employment duties?
Well, I would think that in most cases.
No, in most cases that question perhaps needn't be asked, but I'm asking it. Not for most cases, but what's the Secretary's point of view?
Well, I think that it would be that the person.
Well, he both has to be employed by, that is, his salary has to be paid by the house of worship, and his employment duties have to be within the house of worship. Is that it?
No, that's not it. Because that would exclude, obviously,
it seems to me it would exclude people who are literally covered by the statute.
That's correct. And I would say that the source, the analogy upon which the Secretary is relying here, is the similar problem that's been worked out in the Fair Labor Standards Act cases, where we have the statutory language says employed by an establishment.
Right.
The establishment in that case refers to a physical or geographical location from which a person may go out to work in some other place, but where he is based. And in that case, the establishment may be the local office of General Motors, and his employer may be General Motors, but he is employed by the establishment for the purposes of the Act. And employed by the church, we submit, has a similar meaning in this statute.
Don't get too carried away with this building, please. Because I know of a church in Washington up to a few years ago met in Hogate's restaurant. So don't get too hooked up on that building.
Well, I would assume in that case, Mr. Justice Marshall, that Hogate's restaurant paid the janitor, and that consequently we wouldn't have a problem for purposes of this statute.
Except not charging the janitor.
The other point that I would make about the Secretary's construction of the first exemption is that this exemption is not something, that this construction is not something that the Secretary has dreamed up out of whole cloth as a result of these amendments. this is an exemption. This exemption, as construed, was construed by the Secretary in 1970 at the time that nonprofit organizations became subject to the Act. And it's not a recent development. Congress amended the Act in 1976, knowing that this is the way the Secretary of Labor had construed the Act.
Does the Secretary take the position that an employee of a seminary, religious seminary, is not within B, 1B?
The Secretary's position is that any employee of a religious seminary would not be subject to the coverage of the Act.
Because of 1B.
That's correct. And that is, I think, based in the legislative history of, the 1970 amendments. I would also point out that in 1974, Congress provided in another statute for the coverage of the same people who are being covered here. And consequently, petitioner's argument asked the court to believe not only that Congress was unaware of what the Secretary's construction of the exemptions had been, but also that Congress, without saying a word, intended to withdraw coverage that it already provided. And it seems to me that's quite an assumption, given the remedial purposes of the statute. And third, petitioner's argument asks that the court believe that Congress was simply in error as to the number of people who would be covered by this statute. I think it's important to note that before lunch, the question or the statement was made that in this chart that the Senate Finance Committee, I believe, staff prepared, that it simply said 242,000 employees against the category nonprofit organizations. And the fact of the matter is that that makes perfect sense because of all nonprofit organizations and the various ways that they could be exempted, that they could have their coverage changed. It was only schools that were at issue at that time. And so that all of those employees had to be school employees. And if that figure did not cover parochial school employees, it would naturally be much, much lower.
Did this staff committee presentation occur at a hearing considering the bill?
I don't believe that there is any testimony. It's part of the it's cited in our brief, and it's a report of the Senate committee.
Is there any indication whether the report was ever made known to the Congress before the law was enacted?
I'm not sure that I know the answer to that, although I have no reason to assume that it wasn't made available to Congress. It's not something that was published after the fact. I would finally like to point out that both Congress and the Secretary have seen the need here for a bright line test. I think that it's been pointed out adequately that a very subjective inquiry would be necessitated by reading the B exemption of the statute as applicable to parochial schools.
Well, the 1A and B simply inquires, who are you employed by?
Well,
I thought you had agreed with that.
Well, I think that the problem is this. There's been a lot
and
of talk.
And that's a very bright line. Excuse me.
I think there's been a lot of talk about parochial schools as if they were marbles and that they were all alike. And the question was asked this morning, are all church schools organized in the same way? And the answer was yes. Well, I defy anybody to produce evidence for me that all denominations organize their church schools in the same way. To make an organization's exemption depend on whether the particular doctrines which the organization espouses allow it to incorporate is ludicrous. And that's one of the problems that Congress was concerned with. It's one of the reasons that the Secretary has adopted the construction that he has to say that schools are schools and they're going to be subject to the coverage of the Act.
But seminaries are schools, and yet they're not subject to the coverage of the Act.
And Sunday schools are schools, and they're not subject to the Act. And we would say that that is the proper analogy.
You don't have many paid teachers in Sunday schools, do you?
Again, I cannot speak authoritatively to that. I wouldn't know the answer.
If you count, I think I can take judicial notice of the fact that, generally speaking, in this country, in all faiths, Sunday school teachers are volunteers.
I would just close with one example that follows up on something that the Chief Justice said this morning, and that is, suppose that we have an archdiocesan, a school owned by the Archbishop of Washington in the city of Washington, and he decides that he will close all archdiocesan schools where the enrollment falls below 200 students for 3 years running. The parents in this parish decide that they want to maintain a parochial school for their children. And they go to the Archbishop and they say, if you give us the building, we will run the school. They incorporate, they run the school, they continue to have the same teachers.
Well, then you've taken yourself out of this statute, Bill, I suggest. And your time has expired now, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, except for one thing. Suppose you lose this case, that the exemption is not available.
So Congress can change it.
Or that it is available. Do you think there is then any constitutional question?
No, I don't think there's any constitutional question. I think that the type of legislation that we have here is of the same order of requiring schools to have fire alarm systems. I think that under the guidelines, the dicta in Pierce against the Society of Sisters, this is the kind of concern that the state can rightly have about religious schools. Thank you.
Do you have anything further? No, I think your time has expired also. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.